welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. Thanks so much for joining us here on the program. I appreciate you taking time out of what most of us have, our very busy schedules, to listen to the program. We come your way Sundays at 7 a.m. and p.m., as well as Monday mornings at 1 a.m. We do stream live at richarddugan.com and newspress.com, and we archive these programs at richarddugan.com, the radio show's page. Lots of information. We also link to our guests' websites, so you can go there and you can check out the information that's available as well. Subject we're going to talk about today has to do with we're going to dive into this. It's certainly going to have to do with alcoholism and so forth. I'm not a real big drinker. I don't really have that propensity in my family for the most part. maybe a couple of three generations back, but nothing in the present day. Have a few every once in a while, but I never like to lose control. I never like to get to the point where I don't know what the heck I'm doing, and yet there are a lot of folks who have no clue when that happens, and it's very frustrating for them as well as for others around them. We're going to be talking with the author of Breaking Through, Discovering the Riches Within, and it's the author's journey from alcoholic depths of despair to a motivational speaker who maps the pathway for transformation. And the author and my guest on the phones with us today is Alan McDougall. And thank you so much for joining us on the program today.
Thank you, Richard, and thanks so much for the invitation.
And as I was reading through some of the information in regards to your, not only your story, but your bio, the phrase that came to mind, the content, if you will, was that, well, my goodness, Alan, I mean, you have had one incredible life through childhood. You even worked in a job that was the most incredible metaphor, we might say ironically, for what you ended up going through that has brought you to the place you are today, doing the things that you're doing, trying to help people to get them to move forward in their lives, honestly, through whatever, we'll say, whatever addiction that they might have.
Well, thank you. And hearing those words brought a chuckle. I don't know if you heard it or not, but it brought a chuckle because my life has not been boring. However, where I'm sitting today and the person I am today and the people around me and the opportunities to help us change, I would not change a thing in my life. There's nothing I would change if I had that choice to live over.
Well, and of course, we've talked on this program many times about that concept that if you even could go back and change anything, then you wouldn't be the person that you are today.
Absolutely, absolutely. My struggles from the day I was, 1 year old or whatever up, has made me, just like you said, I'm repeating it, but give me character. I've had a lot of wonderful days. I've had a lot of character building days. And I learned who I was. My biggest question when I quit drinking at the age of 37, physically, going on emotionally about 12, my biggest question was, who am I? And the second biggest question in my life at that age of 37 was, what happens if I quit drinking and no one likes me?
Mm.
Huge, huge questions to me at that time.
And I have to say that for those of us on the other side of the equation, it's quite frustrating because on the one hand, it's like, well, come on, it's Alan's life. And if that's the way he wants to live it, who are we to say otherwise? And yet, and I'll use case in point, it was only after my divorce was final that my family came to me and they said, oh, yeah, we knew that, you know, she really wasn't right for you and da-da-da-da. But, of course, nobody says anything during during the process. So what about that in terms of especially something like this where you're not only wreaking havoc on yourself, your physical body and spiritual, mentally, emotionally, but also on the people directly around you and then in the peripheries?
Right, exactly, and that's like that old saying, that elephant in the living room, and everybody's grabbing at the priceless artifacts in your living room, from the elephant going around out of control to save them, nobody's looking at the elephant.
Yeah, exactly.
And I can say this, that when I was drinking from the my first experience, a magical experience at the age of 12 till I quit in June the 3rd of 1987 at the age of 37, I just loved it. It was my first love affair ever, but I knew that I had a problem. But every time I thought about fixing it, I would go out and get drunk again because drinking was not my problem, Richard. Drinking was a solution to my problem. My behaviors were a problem, but I drank for the effect that everything was going to be okay next day. I got that high, if you would, or that comfortable feeling. I used to have a speech impediment. I always say that I spoke like Mel Tillis but can't sing, for those of you not in the country of music, in the world of country music. Mel Tillis was a country singer, couldn't speak but could sing. Please don't ask me to sing, Richard, I'll decline, and do everybody a favor. But of all the, and it's not just a book about substance abuse or addiction, it's a book about life. It's a timeless book because the issues that I experienced in my life before the world of addiction are timeless, and they're happening in a lot of families. The bullying in schools we hear about, abusive parents, being sick, no self-esteem. Whatever self-esteem I gained at the age of 12, little as it was, alcohol certainly stripped that away from me. But getting back to the original point, now I don't want to wander too much, is that my wife approached me. I was married at the time. My wife approached me three times, and my heart was in my throat when she approached me. She said, "We have to talk about your drinking," and my heart just stopped. And I said, "Sure." She said, "From now on, I don't want you drinking at home anymore. Please go drink in bars." Oh, I said, "Okay." So then about a year later, she said, "We have to talk about your drinking again." I said, "Oh, goodness." I said, "Sure. Okay, what's going on with that?" "Well, I don't want you out anymore. I want you to drink at home." But she never said, "I don't want you to stop. I want you to stop drinking."
Mm.
She never gave me that ultimatum.
So would you say then, obviously in hindsight, that she actually was your enabler?
Yeah, she was, but I say that with utmost respect because we were both too young. Her parents were both alcoholic. Her mother was murdered with an alcoholic in an alcoholic situation. So when I met her in Sudbury in the Hard Rock mining town of Northern Ontario, she fit into my family, or I fit into hers, because of it was common to be drinking all the time. So I didn't have, it was nothing new for her. So she didn't have any other skills. So it's not her fault. It was just a skill that we had learned. One time she said to me, "I'm going to join you drinking." I said, "For God's sakes, lawyer, we can't afford to have both of us drinking."
And there's some real truth in that in most relationships.
There is. So I left my family. I walked out of my youngest, in the book I talk about walking out of my family on my youngest daughter's fifth birthday. I went down to buy her a birthday present and never went home. And you talk about a load of guilt and shame. When I slept in ditches during a six-month period and flop houses. But I always say, Richard, I slept in ditches in front of five-star hotels. I always had a bit of class left in me. But then when I got sober, quit drinking, then I had a lot of amends and talking with my family because I left them to commit suicide by drinking. They were left financially secure. The house was paid, everything else. I didn't want them to sell the house or lose it and continue to change school. So there was some goodness in me at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But that daughter that I walked out on her fifth birthday is her and I are so close today, it's unbelievable, but the grandchildren and her. So I say that story not to impress you, but to impress upon you. Mm-hmm. That anything is possible.
You know, it's interesting the way you phrase that because one of our guests just recently, in her particular work that she's put together called Making Peace with Suicide, her name is Dr. Adele Ryan McDonald, and yep. We even talked about that in terms of the ways in which some of us are committing suicide, but it's taking us several decades to complete the task, whether it be smoking or drinking, mm-hmm. whatever the lifestyle might be. Maybe it's a place that we work. And as a matter of fact, you were a minor. You know, that seems to me like that's a pretty unsafe place to be, mm-hmm. even more so if you're intoxicated.
Yes, but the other thing is, people said to me, how did you work underground every day for 4,000 feet underground every day for 28 years? I said, alcohol played a factor. So there was some sort of false bravado, if you would, that everything would be okay. But you're absolutely right. I mean, it was a perfect, if you would, a kind of an ironic scenario to be in the bottom of the Mother Earth mining. But I also had a bottomless pit that I couldn't fill with anything but alcohol. But the mining scenario was, it helped me hide my addiction, because we didn't have any, we had bosses, Richard, but we didn't use our supervisors because we were on an incentive program. So the more we made a flat hourly rate, but then the more we produced, the more we made. So they never had to worry about us not working. So what a perfect place to hide a hangover, 4,000 feet underground.
Well, that's certainly true.
Go ahead. I kept under the radar. I did not miss time. I did not have any grievances. I did not, if I got hurt somewhat, I wouldn't report it because I didn't want to be visible. I was always below the radar screen until I couldn't be below the radar screen.
I mean, you couldn't work down there forever, you know, and you couldn't stay down there forever.
No. Now, the other side of that is when I got sober at the age of 37, I had a wonderful doctor. She's just a brand new doctor and took me into her practice, and I was like her case study, I think. And she said, given the fact that I drank and smoked two and a half packs a day, I would not have probably lived past the age of 41. The condition my liver was in, but I had no, I didn't have any knowledge of my liver because it wasn't at the point where it was giving me any indication, but she did with tests. So I would have lived, but she said what saved my life, ironically enough, was working in that mine, because we were working in 110, 115 degree heat. I was sweating the hangover and the booze out every morning. I ate like you wouldn't believe. I had big lunches every day. And my age kept me alive. So the mine kind of helped me, kind of saved my life.
It's also very interesting to think about the role that we play throughout our lives, the importance of that role that we play, and the impact that we're going to have on the people around us. We just don't know how we're going to affect people, whatever the role is, whether it is, you know, the alcoholic, or in your case, whether it is the recovering alcoholic who is now out on a speaking tour and a book promotional tour and so on and so forth, now trying to help people who may have family or friends who are going through it, or maybe going through it themselves. You know, I'm sure that somewhere along the way, there must have been people around you who probably thought, and I don't know if they ever shared this with you, but probably thought it just, well, you know, it would be better if he just died. I mean, It put himself out of his own misery.
Yes. And I was one that thought that myself in the later stages. However, getting back to your question, there was a lot of people that loved me much more than I did, both in sobriety and in recovery, in the mm-hmm. beginning stages of recovery. But I'm so blessed, and I can't tell you the ways that I'm blessed, but I'm so blessed in this way that both my parents were both living, my father for 7 years after I quit and my mother for 14, that they could see the changes in me that they knew was inside of me, but I did not know. And so I had a wonderful chance to make amends with my father, I talk about in my book about my handwritten letters, printing with my left hand, like a little boy and telling my father how proud I was and loved him, because we didn't speak about that in our family. Mm-hmm. I talk about all those rewards that I've had giving back to the people that loved me. So, yes, I had a lot of people love me, and I had a lot of strangers love me when I quit drinking. And I just want to talk about, you mentioned the word influence. When I went to fight my first Alcoholic Anonymous meeting, I did not want to be there. I detested everybody there. I went there. The only reason I went there was in a restaurant that had alcohol, so I could go across the hallway and have a drink. True story. I mean, this is my backup plan. I always had a backup plan.
Mm-hmm.
And but the power of the spoken word, just like you're doing on this radio show with your guests, no one knows the power of the spoken word. At my first Alcoholic Anonymous meeting, there was a man, stranger to me, of course, not stranger than me, stranger to me, got up and he said the words, "Hi, my name is Mike, I'm an alcoholic." Everybody says, "Hi, Mike." And then he said about 14 words. He said, "In 2 weeks' time, if I continue with this program, I will have 4 years of continued sobriety. And Richard, as sick as I was, I physically, in my mind, reached out with my open hand, took those words, and put them into my heart." And that was the first message of hope that I'd ever heard in 37 years. Excuse me.
Mm-hmm.
So the power of the spoken word that we may not even know is influencing someone down the road or at that time, that's a gift.
And it reinforces a lot of what we talk about in terms of the power of words. I became extremely frustrated about 20, 25 years ago as I'm listening to, at that time, the latest presidential cycle. And I'm hearing in the primary, I'm hearing all of these words being spoken. And I began to theorize, all right, you have these two sides, and they're going to have, who knows? I mean, right now, on one side, there are like 16 or 17 guys running for the same office. Only one of them is going to get to the next level anyway. And I'm thinking, your odds are 15 to 1 and not great odds. But you're saying all of these things about the other guys. And then when the process is done and the one guy is selected to go on to the next level, the guy goes up there and says, "Okay, now let's all close ranks and join hands, sing kumbaya, and go beat the daylights out of the other guy on the other side of the aisle." Then that process goes through. Words are said about the other guy on the other side of the aisle. And then you win and you say, "Okay, and now let's all join hands as Americans and sing kumbaya and let's make this a better place." And I'm sitting here going, how is that even possible after everything that's been said? And someone said to me, "Well, that's just politics." But you and I both know, Alan,
yes,
words, regardless of the forum, have power. And either you meant what you said at the time you said them, or you didn't. And if you did mean them, you're vicious, and I don't want you in that office. And if you didn't mean them, you're a liar, and I don't want you in that office.
There's two things come to my mind when I hear that scenario. One is, when you're describing that, it sounds like some of the bar fights that I used to get into in the hotel.
I love that.
And the second thing is, you're absolutely right. It's just like, I've lost my train of thought for a second, but it's, when you said about the power of the words,
mm-hmm.
as one of my friends and mentors, Les Brown, says, don't let someone's impression of you become your reality.
Yeah.
See, my mother kept saying to me in probably despair and hopelessness, "You're just going to be like your uncle. You're not going to accomplish anything." And I was told that from a very early age. "You're going to be like this. You're going to be this. You're going to do this." I wasn't that good in school. I hated everything in school. So at the age of 37, I could have said to Mom, "Hey, Mom, I'm where you said I would be." Her impression of me became my reality. So when I quit drinking and had a new circle of influence, I learned to take the same, not the same words, but words of encouragement and build on them. So So you're absolutely right about the power of the word.
The other part of it, too, that, again, it was a frustration for me, and those are issues I have to work through myself, but one of the frustrations for me when I was working for a Christian radio station, and I was there for 15 years, and they would make that same basic statement, you know, although theirs was more in the singular sense, the power of the word. Well, the power of the word, whether you want to have it singular or plural, doesn't matter. It's the same power. And you'd hear the same kinds of things, the railing against others who were not like us or who were right. Who were conducting themselves in less than a godly manner. And just that type of vocabulary and the viciousness. And the only thing I could think of, Alan, was the Shakespearean phrase, "Me dost think thou protesteth too much."
Yeah.
And to explain that, if you are, you need to be very careful, because if that's what you are railing against, you better be careful, because you're probably going to get caught up in it yourself, and then you're going to be eating your own words, so to speak. So please, you know, be careful with what you say. And we talk about that all the time on this program in terms of both the words that you say, but also, and this is coming from my book that I'm still working on, the input that we take in through our eyes, our ears, our noses, our mouths, in terms of the people that we associate and the places in which we live, the materials that we read, the television programs and the movies that we see, and it doesn't matter from what source, the music that we listen to with the lyrics, all of that has power as well as influence. What can you tell me through that period of alcoholism, before you began the road, the sobriety road, what were those kinds of influences in your lives? I mean, were you a churchgoer or not? I mean, you know, it seems to me like, there should have been some help there if that was available.
Well, that's a great question. My life in my downward spiral was, you know, when I left my family on the farm at the age of 18 to go work in the mine, primarily just to get away from them, because I figured it'd be a brand new start for me. But as the old saying goes, no matter where you go, there you are with all of your baggage. And at that time of my drinking, I blamed everybody else for my drinking, of course. That was my biggest circle of influence, was my own thinking. You know, if you had my job working underground, if you had my mortgage, if you had my kids, if you had my wife, if you had this, you drink too. But in the mining circle, that really fit into the camaraderie, if you would, of the miners, because we lived on such a fragile, we didn't know if we were going to work one day with a lunch bag and coming up in a body bag. And so that drinking was totally accepted. Drugs were not, alcohol was. So that was one circle of influence. My friends that I drank with, I would not drink with you, Richard, because you probably, as you said in the beginning, you drank for pleasure. I never drank for pleasure. I strictly drank for effect from 12 years old up to 37. Mm. So I would not drink with a social drinker, because I'd be sitting there upset that you wouldn't drink your drink quicker than I did, so then it wouldn't look bad for me to keep going back.
Sort of a competitive aspect.
Yeah, so I'd just like to take a minute, if I may, and there were 12 of us that had the same issues, and we sit around the same table every day and drink and complain about everything. And my friend I drank with every day, he didn't speak to me from the day that I quit drinking. He did some bad things to me, and we never spoke until last Saturday, actually. He's in hospice. And I talked to his daughter, and I said, "Do you think he'd be willing to see me so we can have a nice chat?" And they said, "Absolutely." So I went into the hospital, and we had a 2.5-3 hour laughing, crying, wonderful amends-making situation. And he said, "Alan," he said, "I'm the last man laying, and you're the last man standing because of choices you made. The other 10 are all gone."
Mm.
You know, wow. So of the decisions that were that I made, or that the world made for me, because that day that I quit drinking, I had three choices which I considered very seriously. One was to continue drinking and probably end up in an institution. Secondly, was to go buy a gun and commit suicide. Or three, do the thing I didn't want to do, was to look at my drinking and probably quit. The union, the Steelworkers Union, helped me a lot with their employee assistance program. And my life, I'm living my life today, Richard, beyond my wildest dreams.
Now, you spent more than 20 years underground as a miner. You also, as you've already stated, you know, grew up in a very abusive situation, especially as a child. And you've come out the other side, and I have to wonder, I mean, this is, from my perspective, it's a weird way of looking at it, but have you ever perceived that in order for you to get where you are today, to be the kind of influence, as we've mentioned before, that you are today, that you, so to in a manner of speaking, didn't really have much of a choice in terms of going through what you went through? Because maybe if you hadn't, you wouldn't have the opportunity of providing the multitude of choices to people today that you have.
Yes, absolutely. I agree with you. I put myself into a corner with no door to get out of except those three choices: institution, suicide, or going to meetings. So I decided I'm being a coward. I went to the meetings. And from that day on, looking back 28 years now, I'm so dry now, Richard, I'm a fire hazard. However.
Come to California.
Yeah, okay. I'll stay in Pittsburgh here. There were choices that I made during my sobriety that led me to the path. But there was so much happenstance and serendipity and things in my life. I met this person, like I met Les Brown, the motivational speaker. My sponsor, Jim, gave me a cassette tape of him doing a speech in the Amway days. It's not over till you win.
I remember
My sponsor, Jim, said, here's a cassette you should listen to. I listened to it so much, Richard, I broke the cassette over 5 years, and it's still in my drawer here in Pittsburgh. That's the meaning. I moved to Pittsburgh to work for the United Steelworkers Union. My friend Jim passes away. His wife said, come into it, because Jim was a reader. She said, Jim wants you to have any book you wanted before he died, for any book you want, or 5 or 10. I picked up Les Brown's book. I moved it to Pittsburgh. I'm in my office. I have the book on my desk, ready to put it into a box. The clerical staff come in, and she said, is that Les Brown's book? And I said, yes. She said, my friend works with him, and I'd like to call her and talk to her about you. So I said, go ahead. The next weekend, I met Les Brown in Orlando, and we spent a 5-year mentorship program together. So the serendipity or the happenstance, if my clerical staff had to come in 5 minutes later, that conversation would never have happened.
And that's very true. And that's one of the reasons why I have tried to take the perspective in my life and share the same perspective with other people. I mean, I consider myself to be very fortunate that I've been in the right place at the right time. I used to think more specifically in regards to my career, but actually in as far as my life is concerned. I mean, I look back on some situations where I should have been scared out of my mind about the possibilities ahead, and there was no fear whatsoever. Whether it was losing my job and my present wife losing her job, and we would both have to get new jobs back in Phoenix, or move to Santa Barbara, and I had no fear whatsoever. Because one of the things that I remember from all of the intensives that I've been through, personal growth programs, all the interviews that I've done, such as this one, all the books I've read, the people I've spoken with, the tapes that I've listened to, and so on and so forth, they've all said basically the same thing. When you come to a precipice, As my wife said, on March 1st of 2006, when we were sitting in front of the television, both unemployed, watching TV, and she came and sat next to me and said, "I'm scared. I feel like we're on a precipice." I said, "Well, they've all said the same thing. When you get there to the precipice or cliff, you do two things. You jump and you trust." So we did.
Yep. Yep.
But for some folks, that's really hard because fear really can grip you. Whereas for me, there was this this calm that I could not explain. I mean, I didn't even think about it at the time until I reflected on it later. I couldn't believe how calm I was. My God, my wife and I are both unemployed. And here we are going to Santa Barbara for a week to relax and so forth, because we really hadn't had a vacations up to that point, as well as to look for a place to live and places to work and so forth. And again, just no fear. Just, you know, we enjoyed ourselves. We talked to people and so forth. Back to Phoenix, put the house up for sale, and away we went. The only other time that I can recall in recent history that that happened for me was when I was sitting on the edge of a giant granite slab on the edge of a cliff. Had to have been 400, 500, 600 feet down to the ocean. And this was the North Atlantic. This was an island off of Ireland, Inishmore. And I was sitting there taking pictures and had no fear until about 8 hours later when I was back in the cottage, stone cottage, snug, safe, and warm in my bed. And that's when the fear hit, which was very strange. But we do. We don't think of other options, other possibilities or choices when the emotions take over. It's very hard to do that.
Yeah, there are a couple of things come to my mind when I hear those stories. Is one of the quotations of one of the things that was I wrote down a long time ago is your ship comes in under calm waters, and to get rid of that fear that I had. Nothing was happening in my life, but once I learned to become calm and to trust, then my life started to be one of service and abundance and value. And you talk about the openness to new ideas and the trust. I used to say to Jim all the time, "How am I going to do this? How am I going to stay sober? I won't be able to drink at my daughter's wedding." He said, "How old's your daughter?" I said, 12. That's how much I was living in the future.
Wow.
She was 42 weeks ago and never has been married and has a wonderful life as a school teacher. I would not have lived to see even her at the age of 16, but I was living in the future. So Jim, with his wonderful patience and anger and gruffness, said to me, "I'm tired of that word how." He said, "Let's look at that word how, because I'm tired of you asking me." He said, "Let's break it down." He said, "The H is for honesty to ask for help." And he said, "The O is for openness to new ideas and trust." And he said, the W is for the willingness to try to try something new and to try that openness on a daily basis. That's how simple it is. It's not easy, but that word how also really helped change my thinking process.
We're talking with Alan McDougall. He is the author of, I guess we certainly can refer to it as your memoirs. That's one of the things called, by the way, it's entitled Breaking Through, Discovering the Riches Within. And I have to say, when I first, when I see the word memoir, I think about maybe one day telling my story and thinking, okay, I can really only speak about what I experienced. I can't put in what other people's perceptions are, even if they told me what they are, because that's theirs. I've got to keep it first person all the way through. At least I've got to wait for everybody who I'm going to include, I've got to wait for them all to die. Before I can write it, because I don't want to be sued, you know. It's like, hey, that's how I remember it, kind of thing. certainly, you know, you went through some very trying times, and I'm wondering, did you ever have that kind of a thought or those kinds of questions as far as, you know, should I really include this in there? Or was that the farthest thing from your mind? You just needed to get the story out.
I gave that a lot of thought. The book was a 25-year dream.
Oh, I don't feel so bad now because I've been working on mine since 2001.
Oh, and mine was a 25-year dream. I never put anything on paper until 3 or 4 years ago. But I had to go through that 20-year period because I wanted my book to be a book of value.
Mm-hmm.
So to have a book of value, I had to live a life of value.
Mm.
So it took me 24... My book is not about my drinking and my quitting and the change. It's about what you can do with your life after you go through any change.
Yeah.
After you go through any turmoil. And listen, believe me, whoever's listening on this show, if I can do it, I'm telling you, anybody can do it. But getting back to your question, I have... I told my story. I talked to him. No one saw the manuscript before I had it printed. My sister is still living. We have a wonderful relationship. She got a few questions asked from family members about what she thought of the book and how she could hold her head up high and all this stuff. And she said, one, she always calls me my brother, not my name. She said, my brother wrote the book. It's his story. I never saw it before it was printed, so I did that for a reason, so she would not be inclusive in that decision. Second of all, she said, I've read the book, I'm proud of my brother, and every word in the book is true.
Mm.
So, and that was my rationalization. I have a couple of relatives are not entirely happy with me. However, that is on them. My book is my book is my truth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, you're not there trying to expose other people. You're trying to, if you will, expose yourself.
Yes.
And place yourself in that kind of a position to say, hey, and as you, I think, very eloquent said, if I can do it, then so can you.
Yeah, I kind of wish that, like when I look back at my life, I'll be 65 in a couple of weeks. And when I look back at my life, when I look at that young man that was mining and floundering and a husband and a father, if you would, it's like a totally, totally different person, totally different. So I wish that people could see me, could have seen me then somehow and then see me now. And it's not my success. I'm a success, Richard, in spite of myself. Never forget this. My best thinking got me sleeping in ditches. So when I opened up to other people's ideas, good things started to happen. Jim reminded me that on a daily basis. He said, don't you take any credit. I said, when can I speak in a meeting? He said, you got nothing to say for a year. He said, your best thinking got you in ditches and flop houses. Like he was a reality check man.
Mm.
And so I keep myself humble. Humble and honesty bring me serenity.
Mm.
And I never forget that my best thinking got me sleeping in ditches, so I'm open to people around me that know things that I don't know to help me along, even today. Even today.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Alan McDougall, and we're going to continue doing that. The website, by the way, is AM for Alan McDougall, ampublicspeaking.com. I'm Richard Dugan. This is Tell Me Your Story. Stay tuned.
Tell me your stories. I'll do my best to understand you.
Welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. We're talking with Alan McDougall, and we're talking about a lot of different things in relation to, of course, his work called Breaking Through, Discovering the Riches Within. And I'm thinking that Alan, it seems that there is a theme that is beginning to run through our society today, even though it may not be through the institutions that we are aware of, or but maybe in pockets throughout this country as well as around the world, more so. You know, the more civilized areas where people are beginning to understand that the riches that not only that you talk about, but that we talk about regularly on this program, quite honestly, you couldn't find a dollar sign within a half a, within a light year of what we're talking about, and that you could do away with the dollar sign and all the stuff that it can get you, because if you have the stuff you're talking about, none of the rest of it matters.
Exactly. And that's the whole premise of my book. And I talk about this in every one of my book signings and interviews and my speaking engagements. I worked every day from surface to 4,000 feet underground. I was paid handsomely for good work to get good minerals out of the ground, gold, platinum, copper, nickel, etc., etc. However, when I started mining the 18 inches from my head to my heart, through a lot of work, a lot of tears, a lot of openness, a lot of willingness, a lot of help from other people, both inside the circles of Alcoholics Anonymous and professional counselors, and people that loved me more than I did, the richness that I have found in my soul or in my heart, wherever they are stored, are much more valuable to me and the people I service in this world.
Well, certainly echo that. I look back on all of the people who have had an influence in my life. It's one of those interesting facts that sometimes we don't acknowledge, in terms of where we are. There are some folks who will they'll say, "Man, I got here on my own. I pulled up my bootstraps, if you will, and I did it all by myself." Well, on one level, I suppose you could say that, but the reality is that you didn't do it all by yourself. We all have help. It's that analogy of the ladder, and we're all climbing the same ladder, and there's someone above you, and there's someone below you. And the one above you is assisting you to continue to climb if you get weary. And you, in turn, assist the person below you when they get weary. And that's just kind of the truth of it. I remember that little campaign that went on regarding small business. This was, I don't know if it was during one of the last election cycles or what have you. I don't know if you remember this, but I did it on my own, I think, was like the slogan. And I thought, well, like I said, there's a certain truth to that, but also there's a certain mistruth, because you didn't do it on your own. You rely on the customers who buy your product or service. You rely on the raw materials providers to provide those raw materials. And on, I mean, I could go through the list, but I won't. And I think that, again, we were not put here to live solitary lives. I think that's the biggest thing of all. You know, there are 7.5 billion people on this planet, and I believe that there are 7.5 billion M-class planets, if you will, in the universe. And if it was the great intelligence or God or universal power that wanted us to live solitary lives, we'd all be living on a separate planet, solo. But we're not.
That's right. And like that just echoes what I said a couple of minutes ago, is I'm a success. But if I take myself out of it, I'll be fine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And trust other people. I talk about in the book something as simple as, and some of the listeners may think this is kind of offbeat, but I was offbeat. That's why I had to reach out for help. When I look at pictures of me at the age of 37, I look dead. I had dead eyes. I dedicated a whole chapter to my happy eyes. I always wanted happy eyes. So I went to meetings. And I found this guy, this man, Sunday morning, and I was maybe sober 3 years, and he had the happiest eyes I'd ever seen. I said, wow, he has what I want. So first of all, I introduced myself to him. I didn't tell him about the eyes. But I found out he wasn't on any medication. He was a happy man. And I listened to him. I went to meetings that he went to. We became quasi friends. I would listen to what he was talking about. If he was reading a book, I'd go buy the book. And you know something, Richard? In a short period of time, I had happy eyes. So everything that I have today, I begged, I borrowed, and I've stolen from other people that had what I wanted. Because when I started this life, this new life 28 years ago at the age of 37, I was beat spiritually, emotionally, physically, intellectually. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know where to turn. And everything I have today, I begged, borrowed, and stolen from other people.
Hmm. Well, you know, that's one of the reasons why, because as I said, I'm doing some work myself and on some different things, and I want to use some quotes and so forth from say some lyrics to songs. I'm thinking, okay, do I need to go to this person and get permission to use this, or if I just use a portion of it, can I still use it? You know, I'm not trying to demean, degrade them or what they've done. I'm trying to make a point with what they've said. They said it so well. And so, you know, I sometimes, I find that fascinating too. We're influenced and it starts getting me down a trail of, on the issue of, for example, of intellectual property rights. In that if we're each of us influenced by the people that went before us, and then the people behind us are influenced by us, then how can we genuinely attribute that to us when it was actually because of all of these influences? It's like all of the inventions. They're nothing more than, you know, this, so to speak, you know, the phrase, they made a better mousetrap. Mm-hmm. But it's still a mousetrap. So do you give, you know, so do you give credit to the original mousetrap builder? Well, he was trying to catch a mouse, and even before he built that particular trap, somebody built something else. It's like it's a progression, and it's I think it's important to acknowledge that progression, that process of, can I use the term evolution? And I think that even in our individual lives, such as what you did, I mean, you did have two lifetimes. I mean, you're living your second lifetime. Even though you're nearly 65, I'm living my second lifetime. I'm only 55. And that was my transition point, and my reincarnation, if you will, took place at the age of, 38, 39, when I, you know, out of my first divorce, my first and last, I hope. So I think these are the kinds of things, too, that you know, you talk about your happy eyes. And I remember when I had a lens implant and I was able to see, I make it a point now, without glaring or staring, to look people in the eye. Mm-hmm. Now that I can really see them and I can focus on them. That eye contact just really is so valuable. It does speak volumes, I think. So when you talk about your happy eyes, I think that's fantastic.
Yeah. I look at pictures now, but you talk about my second life. people say to me that I think out of kindness, not out of truth probably, that I look younger than my years. However, I say my answer to that is, well, that's fine, but I'm very immature, so I guess my age is showing through my maturity level. But my youth or I wake up every morning excited because I'm starting out on my third career with my book and my book signings and my motivational speaking. When I go back to my hometown up in Canada, I see miners that I worked with a long time ago if they're still living.
Mm-hmm.
And because they're not healthy when they left. I left early, so to speak. And they're sitting around talking about what happened back in 1972, and that's fine, but I want to sit with someone, even a stranger, and talk about what's coming up in 2016, 17, and 18.
Yeah.
That's my excitement. That's my youth. I've been called childish in my life, and I've been called childlike in my life. But I think the definition of childish is self-centered.
Yes.
Childlike is other-centered.
Yes.
And I have this amazing, I just can't express it over the phone enough that I just am amazed at my life. I'm totally amazed.
Well, I think that it's fantastic, and I applaud you for the success that you have in your life. And to that end, I also noticed that in the back of your book, you actually have a poem entitled Success. I guess this was from your old teacher, Mr. McKay.
Mr. McKay.
Wrote the following poem, which you included here in your memoir.
Yes, Mr. McKay was my teacher from grade 1 to grade 8. He was a retired World War II drill sergeant, so we listened to him. He was very vocal, and I got up every year at the age of grade 1 to grade 8 and could not recite my speech. I had to make a speech every year, and I would cry because I stuttered so much, and I thought the whole world was laughing at me. And then at the end of grade 8, he said, Alan, you're going to go into high school. You need to get up there and keep doing it till you do it. And as Les Brown said, 50 years later, anything worth doing is worth doing badly till you get better at it. So I wish I had Les Brown in the class when I was there in 1959 or 58. But anyway, getting back to the poem, Mr. McKay wrote that poem in 1932 and put it as a young man and put it up in the attic, in his attic. And went to World War II and then came back and began teaching and found it just before he, about 20 years after he retired, he found it. And then him and I wrote letters back and forth after I quit drinking, telling him that I thanked him so much for all the lessons in life that he taught us besides the ABC. And he sent me the poem. He said, no one has ever published this poem. Nobody's ever read it but my family. I want you to keep it. And as a result of that, I put it into my book.
Mm. Well, I'm glad you did. I'm going to leave it to the listener to get a copy of your book, which is available not only through your website, which is ampublicspeaking.com. It's also available through Amazon. It's available at Barnes & Noble and other outlets, Kindle and so forth. And we encourage you to check out the website as well, ampublicspeaking.com. Again, the title of the book is Breaking Through. When you start to, and you said that, you know, the book itself, you know, was more than a 25-year process. When you started to put pen to paper, I'm curious as to whether or not that was another challenge or hurdle just to get started putting it down on paper.
No, it was not. I'll tell you why. Because I've learned in life that what I don't know, I put people in my life that know what I don't know to help me. So I am not good in computer. I never will be, and that's not a negative connotation. I just won't be. So I recorded every word of that book onto a Radio Shack tape. I went to Radio Shack, bought a whole bunch of little 30-minute tapes. My goal, Richard, was every week to have three tapes completed, three one-hour tapes. I would do that at my coffee break or my lunchtime or driving in my car, recording this recorder by memory. And then I would send it off to a woman in Baltimore by the mail who I never met, and she would transcribe it, send it back, and then I would edit it, proof it, move it around on paper and magic marker. It was done old school because for two reasons. One, if I was typing, I would lose myself in the process, not in the thought and the emotions. And someone told me a long time ago, if you're going to write something on paper, verbalize it if you want to get the emotion on the paper. And I've had a lot of comments back from people who read the book and said, I felt your pain, or I felt what it was like working in the mine. I could experience it. And I believe somewhat it's because I verbalized, I recorded every word.
Hmm.
So I did not put pen to paper.
I'm curious if A, you still have those tapes.
Yes.
And B, if you've ever gone back and listened to them.
Yes.
And
not all of them, some of them, yes, I have.
And what's been your impression?
Well, I'm just glad it's done, I guess. However, I'm in the middle of writing another book right now. It'll be out in January. But and by using the same principles. I just, what I think of was, when I hear those tapes, is not the words that that I think of, it's the time frame that I did that work.
Mm.
I got up at 6 in the morning. I come into my office when no one was here. I dedicate an hour to myself every day, minimum, because I tell you this, if you can't dedicate an hour to yourself and to your goals and to your dreams and to your well-being and to your whatever you want it to be, if you cannot dedicate an hour, then we have to reschedule our days. So I dedicated an hour myself every morning, and so that's what came to my mind when I heard those old tapes. The diligence, the persistence, and the satisfaction of walking to the U.S. Post Office in Pittsburgh sometimes on a Friday, because that was my goal, three tapes a week, and sometimes I'd stop at the coffee shop at Starbucks to finish the last tape, but I had them completed.
Well, now, you say that you're doing this again with your next book. You're recording it on tape. So obviously, you have a transcriber, obviously.
Yes.
And so they basically... But how did you know where to stop and start? Did you have an outline of, okay, I'm going to talk now today on this tape about... How did you... And I know we're getting into sort of the structure of this, but I find this fascinating.
Well, how I did it was I just recorded everything from... in chronological age, my age
okay.
up, my
there we
childhood
go.
Up, that was my thing. And then I got all those copies back on Word, printed them out,
mm-hmm.
and then deleted, added, switched them around, magic marker, old school, used flip charts to help me. And then I put everything together, and then I had somewhat of a manuscript, if you would, very, very rough. Some people that work with me in the Les Brown Platinum Speaking Bureau have also written books. I reached out to them and said, do you know of someone that can help me put this together? They came up with a gentleman that lived at that time in California. I talked with him over the phone. He said, send me the manuscript. I'll see if I can help you, put it in chronological order, edit it, proof it, but not change the story. And I said, well, but before I do that, Dan, I want to come out and visit you because I want you to know me.
Ah.
I said, the book is an extension of me.
Yeah.
If you don't know me, I do not wish anyone to do the book. It wasn't about income. I wrote the book for a dual purpose, impact and income. And I've done both. So I went out to visit Dan with the script, but never opened it. And I just got to know him over a period of 4 days. We did talk, and he did not drink as well. And we laughed and coffee. And then I gave him the manuscript. He put it together, would send me chapters at a time for me to look at. And then I had saved up for 5 years motivational messages that I received from my sponsor, not Jim, but Noel. Jim had passed away. Jim would send me motivational messages from Hazleton.
Mm-hmm.
I saved them up on my website. I had over 5,000 motivational messages saved up. And then I would go through them after I read what Dan put on the, had cleaned up my chapters. Then I would go to all these 5,000 motivational messages and pick out the verse, title of the chapter through those motivational messages that fit that chapter in the book.
Hmm.
That's how I did that. Then I put in some pictures, pictures that were meaningful to me of my mother, who we had a horrendous relationship for a long time, and then we had the most wonderful relationship. If you're going to write a book about redemption, you have to write about the bad things before you can write about the good things.
Yeah. They say that you have to embrace all of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So... that's how I put the book together, and then I went back out to California, and we spent all day looking in a liquor store, in a store that sells alcohol. We both don't drink.
Mm-hmm.
We're taking pictures. We're taking pictures of bottles of whiskey to put on the cover. But and if I can take 30 seconds, if I may,
sure.
I just want to talk about the cover story.
Yes, please.
I met through a friend of his who lives in Vermont. She helped me she helps design book covers. So it was all people who knew people who knew people who knew people.
Yeah.
So anyway, we got these pictures of the alcohol. I felt so bad to the guy that owned the store in California. that I and we went out with no purchases, so I had to buy a bag of potato chips to make me feel that I wasn't wasting his time. However, when I got to meet through telephone calls this woman up in Vermont called Carrie, she talked. She read the script, and then she had put together a picture of a tree, on the roots underneath the ground, and then the tree with a bud on top, signifying my life as a miner and in the skid row, and then growth. So then we got the picture of the bottle, and then I come up with, let's put a mining scene inside the bottle as a label. So if you look at it, if you go onto my website or go into Barnes & Noble and look at my book, the light at the end of the tunnel is a heart shape.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's where my richness is. There are 12 railroad ties lit up in the mining scene for the 12 steps of any recovery program. There are two pieces of timber on the left-hand side. And if you look closely in the timber holding up the rock, there are two letters in the timber hidden, AA. Then if you look at the word breaking, the ink is fragmented.
Mm-hmm.
However, if you look at the word through, it's solid.
Yeah.
To signify the change. If you look at the top of the bottle, there is no cap because that was my history to throw the cap away. I never put a cap on until the bottle was finished. And if you look at the shot glass in front, in the front left-hand right-hand corner, as you're looking at it, it's on its side because it, to me it signifies it's out of control. And then if you look closely at that shot glass, you'll see the alcohol leaking out onto the table. And that was my life leaking out of me.
Mm. A lot of great symbolism.
Oh, yes. And I had an interview a couple of weeks ago, and the announcer said, that has more symbolism than the U.S. dollar bill. I said, and the book is worth more, too.
Well, I'm not sure if I'd say worth more, but it certainly has greater value.
It does.
Greater value in that respect. I think that's wonderful.
That's what I meant. So, like I say, and it just came from me looking at the picture, and I'm a great believer in symbolism, so that's the story. That's the cover story.
Well, I think it's important for people to understand that you know it certainly took some thought, especially when you start describing the cover art, the front cover art, as well as putting it together. And I'm wondering, you already recorded the book. To create the book in the first place, you have any plans on making an audiobook? Have you done that already?
I've looked at it right now. Thanks for asking, Richard. I've not. I've looked at it. Yes, I priced it out. I've got some different people that would do the voiceover. However, that's where it's at right now in the preliminary stages because I really want to focus on finishing my second book. And my second book is going to be on my life of dealing with victims of death. What I do for the Steelworkers Union for the last 10 years is whenever we have a fatality, I go and help the family.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing with the investigation, just with helping the family.
Yeah.
Make sure that they're represented legally, counseling. And we have a fatality every 9 days in our union.
Mm.
And we have a critical injury. So I travel a lot, but my next book coming out is the lessons that I've learned from the families that I'm there to give comfort, they have taught me so much.
Yeah.
That's my next book.
Well, we look forward to that. I want to thank you so much. I still have a couple of more questions I want to ask you, but I really do appreciate the time that you've taken and your story as you've shared it with us here on the program. Just want to remind our listeners that the website to go to find out more about Alan McDougall and his work and his book called Breaking Through, it is AM for Alan McDougall, ampublicspeaking.com. That's ampublicspeaking.com. And before I let you go, my final three questions that I ask all of my guests. Number one, who is Alan McDougall?
He's a man. I've been called a Renaissance man. I've been called lots of things in my life. But I guess the Renaissance man, as I see a Renaissance man, is a man that has had great struggles, great successes, had some very, very challenging years, has cried a lot, however, laughed a lot more, But all that has given me a heart of compassion, empathy. I totally live in the moment. I enjoy each person I talk with and each day. And if the legacy, I guess if I had to put a legacy on my headstone, I would say something like a man who lived life fully and doesn't have any regrets.
What is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you're doing now?
I pretty much achieved, honestly, what I have, what I've wanted to do is there's nothing better in my, this is my interpretation, there's nothing better in this earth, this world for me than service work. And life has directed me to service. So when I can help someone at their lowest time when they've lost a son or a daughter or a wife or a husband, and I go in there and I can sit there and help them, that is the ultimate. That's the ultimate. I also love getting up on the stage and having fun. I have a wonderful sense of humor. I love getting up and speaking. I have the ability to make people cry at my seminars, my speeches, and make people laugh. And I'm living a life, like I say, I have, that's my two loves.
Mm. And who inspires you?
People that probably don't even know they do. You inspire me, Richard. And talk shows inspire me because I know that I want to be the best that I can be to be honored to be on this show. And that inspires me to keep doing what I'm doing and being extraordinary in being able to give a good quality interview that has depth, meaning, humor, and good conversation.
Well, I have thoroughly enjoyed our conversation, and I think it has all of those qualities, and I thank you so much for, again, taking so much time and sharing with us here on the program, as well as the work Breaking Through, Discovering the Riches Within, as well as the website ampublicspeaking.com. And if you find yourself out here on the West Coast in the Santa Barbara area, we would love to have you in studio to continue this conversation.
That will happen. And if anyone wants to send me an email on my website, I promise you I will answer them all. And they're free to write a note. I have my mailing address. If you want to write a little note, anybody wants to write a note, I will answer back with a handwritten message.
And that's Alan, A-L-L-A-N, at ampublicspeaking.com.
And it's all on the website. Thanks, Richard. I truly, truly enjoyed this.
I did as well. I thank you, and I thank you for listening to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. We're giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time, love to all.